I'd like to call this meeting of the Capital Investment Committee to order. Don't quite have a quorum at this time, so we won't be moving to approve the minutes or anything. Today, we're going to listen to some reports from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and St. Paul and Minneapolis on a couple of projects. And just want to emphasize again, from what I said yesterday about two-thirds of the way through the meeting when I got here, and that is that what we're trying to do is, with some projects, just to investigate how the money was spent. Are there procedures that are being followed, or should there be some procedures that are being followed that we're not doing? The intent isn't to denigrate or embarrass anyone. It's just to try to establish a measure of accountability with some projects. And so with that, we will continue. And I believe the first on the agenda is Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Will you step on down, please? Please identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Tingerthal. I'm Commissioner at the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And we're actually delighted that this committee has asked for a report on the use of bonding to provide the capital dollars needed to invest in certain types of affordable housing all over the state of Minnesota. What we'll be reporting on are two programs that have existed since 2012, and I hope you'll find that the track record of how those dollars have been used to be what you were expecting. So at Minnesota Housing, our mission is that since housing is the foundation for success, we collaborate with individuals, communities, and partners all over the state to create, preserve, and finance affordable housing. For those of you who are not on our policy committees, the Housing Finance Agency is an independent agency of the state with the authority to issue bonds and is governed by a board of directors that is appointed by the governor. So we're a little different from other state agencies, and that's why we're here talking to you about bonding for housing.
Now, Commissioner, if you just pause for a few seconds, we now have enough members to declare a quorum. And so, Representative Lilly, have you had time to peruse the minutes of the February 21st, and would you move their approval?
You were there.
I do move, Mr. Chair. Sorry. How do you like my voice?
Very good. No comments. It has been moved. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes have passed. Continue again, please.
Thank you very much. So I mentioned that our agency, established back in 1971, is an independent agency. In that regard, we are separately audited from the state of Minnesota, and we also are reviewed by the rating agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's, on a separate basis from the state of Minnesota. And we are currently rated AA1, AA+. So we are able to raise capital in the markets at very attractive rates. No state appropriations are used to pay the agency's operating costs. We are allowed to earn interest on the investments that we make in affordable housing, and we use those earnings to operate the agency, and any additional earnings are plowed back into programs that are allowed under our statute. And also, just to give you a sense, state appropriations are only about 7 to 10% of our overall agency program budget. So last year, We provided financing for over $1 billion worth of housing in the state, and that ranges from single-family mortgages to mortgages on affordable rental properties around the state, as well as home improvement loans and our housing trust fund. But even with all that activity, only 7 to 10% are made up out of state appropriations. So let me talk for just a minute about the need for affordable housing. In Minnesota, there are over 600,000 households that pay more than 30% of their income for housing. 30% of income is thought to be the amount to spend out of your household budget for housing that's deemed to be sustainable and affordable. So that's reflected in mortgage lending, underwriting, et cetera. And just to give you a sense of comparison, since 2000, that number has increased from 350,000 households to 600,000 households as the cost of housing has continued to go up while the salaries have stayed fairly stagnant. Also, more than 7,500 Minnesotans, mostly children and their parents, are homeless on any given day. So going back, we have received bonding allocations three times, in 2012, in 2014, and in 2015, for a combined total of $145.5 million. And as I'll show you in a few minutes, all of those dollars are hard at work in your communities, many of them in completed projects. So the most important question that I think I need to answer for this committee is, why do we use what are called housing infrastructure bonds, which are appropriation bonds, which I know some of you have concerns about? The reason that we come to you with this type of bond is that most housing in the state is privately owned. And the reason for that is that two of the most common sources of federal resources that are used to do rental housing are tax credit resources. And in order for someone to use tax credits, they have to be a taxpayer. And so, therefore, they can't be a nonprofit or a governmental entity. So most of these are set up as limited liability corporations, and therefore, under the state constitution, they cannot utilize general obligation bonds. In every other respect, the bonds are very similar. Because they are appropriation bonds rather than GO bonds, they have a slightly higher rate on them. The last two issues that we did, the rate was about 30 basis points higher, so 0.30% higher, and were very competitively bid in the marketplace. In fact, we were able to be so competitive in the marketplace that we, from the previous allocations, have approximately enough debt service to support an additional $20 million worth of bonds. And there has been some discussion among your members of the possibility of a non-monetary bill moving forward to allow us to change our current authorization to allow the issuance of another $20 million without you having to allocate additional debt service. So that was one of the reasons that I understand the committee wanted to hear from us today. All of the properties are rented to low and moderate income tenants, and these bonds then, because they're compatible with these federal resources, leverage considerable other federal and local resources as well as private investment. The way that we've written housing infrastructure bonds, they're eligible for three kinds of uses. The preservation of federally assisted rental housing, and the reason for that is those buildings carry with them federal rental subsidies of substantial size that cannot be moved to other buildings, and so it's been felt for a couple of decades that it makes sense for us to preserve those properties and keep making capital investments in them when necessary. The biggest use of the bonds has been for what we call permanent supportive housing. That's housing for people who either have disabilities or who have suffered homelessness in the past. And it simply is permanent housing that also has with it supportive services to help people reestablish themselves in a stable living environment. The third use is a fairly limited use, and that is to provide financing for land for home ownership through community land trusts. The reason we don't use it more extensively for home ownership is that tax-exempt bonds cannot be used for the actual structures of single-family homes, but they can be used for the land if it is to be maintained as affordable as it is in community land trusts. So how do we stand with regard to the availability of financing? In the three sets of financing we received, every time we went out for competitive proposals, we received 3 to 4 times as many requests as we were able to fund. In 2016, there was more than $60 million in eligible projects that we could not fund due to the fact that there were no housing infrastructure bonds and no bonding bill last year. That would have been the normal cycle. We received $76 million for the $20 million that was available in 2015, and we received requests to fund 14 projects and were able only to do 4. So there is a tremendous amount of remaining demand out there. With regard to leverage, $120 million in housing infrastructure bonds has resulted in over $214 million in total development costs. And with regard to the use for federal housing preservation, we usually preserve $4 in federal rental assistance for every $1 that we put into the capital investments in those housing. With regard to supportive housing, we've used it for a broad variety, and you'll hear more about that from the other two testifiers today. But we've included housing for veterans, both here in the Twin Cities and in St. Cloud, housing for people with mental illness in Grand Rapids and Winona and Owatonna. And we've also seen a decline in homelessness in Minnesota of 13% over the last 2 years, and that is very unlike other states that have good, strong economies. In many states where the cost of housing is going up, the amount of homelessness is going up. By focusing on building permanent supportive housing in Minnesota, we've been able to see homelessness actually go down. And for veterans and for those who have suffered chronic homelessness, we've reduced homelessness by more than 50% since 2010. So it really is a matter of if people don't have a place they can live, they will be homeless. And by providing actual units of housing, as we do with housing infrastructure bonds, we can really begin to make a dent in the homelessness issue. With regard to federally assisted housing, you might ask how many people live in that type of housing. It's 38,000 Minnesotans, and these properties, whether it's funded originally by HUD or USDA, are located in all 87 counties of Minnesota. And the median income of people living in projects like that in your communities is about $13,000 a year. So it often houses some of the lowest income folks in your communities. The next slide, I won't go into this with a lot of detail, but I did want to show you that we've been very good stewards of these dollars. All of the projects that have been selected, and that's 22 multifamily projects and 14 single-family projects, have been either completed or are under construction. That's almost 1,900 units of housing located all over the state, which you can see on the next slide. The red triangles show where we've used housing infrastructure bonds or nonprofit bonds, and GO bonds, which we'll talk about in a minute, are shown in the blue circles. So you can see that it is very much a program for all of Minnesota. I'm just going to very quickly go through a couple of actual examples. I know on the Capital Investment Committee, you're usually dealing with projects that are tangible, that you know that they're there. with regard to a future allocation of housing infrastructure bonds, you would know that we would be selecting projects that would be similar. One of the first projects we did was the Upper Post Veterans Community at Fort Snelling, 58 units, and these are all supportive housing for veterans, and it has been a hugely successful project that is just a short distance away from the VA hospital. Just this past year, we also opened a project for veterans immediately adjacent to the Veterans Hospital in St. Cloud. Another project that had a tremendous amount of community support was what is called 66 West. This is currently under construction right in downtown Edina, just north of Southdale. And this project, when completed later this year, will house 38 homeless youth and is sponsored by an organization that also has recently opened a similar project on University and Pryor in St. Paul, 44 units of housing for homeless youth. And finally is a project that you'll hear more about in just a minute, Gage East in Rochester, which provides supportive housing both for youth and for families with kids that have issues with mental illness. When it comes to preservation, just a couple of projects. One in Rochester, the square on 31st Street, which the senator carrying this bill said, yeah, that project was looking pretty tired before you made those improvements. 104 units on the north side of Rochester. And then a project that many of you probably passed by on I-94, Skyline Towers, was actually 504 units that were preserved just last year. On home ownership, a couple of examples. The West Hennepin Affordable Land Trust was able to acquire land for 25 homes scattered throughout Hennepin County. Finally, I want to wrap up with the other part of our history, and that is in addition to the housing infrastructure bonds, we do request GO bonds and have received them for housing that can be owned and is owned by public entities. Public housing serves 36,000 low-income Minnesotans, including 12,000 kids, and more than 90% of the public housing units in Minnesota are more than 20 years old. Again, we think we have a terrific track record with the $25.5 million you've entrusted to us, financing 49 projects all over the state of Minnesota, with 75% of those projects located outside of the metro area. I have just a couple of examples here because you also hear a speaker on this project. Dunedin Terrace in St. Paul, 88 units over on the west side that are gradually being rehabbed, and also Twin Towers in Austin, which is 204 units, mostly for people with, that are elderly and with disabilities. And finally, the Lakeview High-Rise in Wilmer, another 121 units. This was a plumbing stack replacement that really required a major amount of investment because it basically had to be ripped out of the entire building and replaced. So that very quickly, Mr. Chair, is our overview. I'm happy to take any questions that you may have time for about either of these projects that we feel very proud of having worked with your communities to bring to your communities.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mrs. Tegethal. Number one, I have just one comment and then one question. I know the Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, Shelito, that's one of his main missions is to eliminate the homelessness of our veteran population. So I think that mission is being accomplished, and there's still work to be done, of course. But on page two, in terms of you mentioned there is nearly 600,000 households in Minnesota paying more than 30% of the. Are any of those households or families, they might both be working, but they extended themselves and bought too big of a house, or one was laid off and now they're not able to make you know, these payments and so forth. Is that any part of this population?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, there certainly could be people like that in this number. However, I will say that the vast majority of households that are in this 600,000 are really renter households, and there the affordability is an even worse picture. More than 50% of the households that make less than half the median income are paying more than 50% of their income for housing. So it really is, you know, there may be a few, but it really is a pretty critical issue, especially for renters.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I just need to clarify something. These investments, they're in low-interest loans, or are they in grants, or combination, or I may be asking a question that has different answers across your whole presentation, but the money, when I see like a GO bond proceeds, $2.3 million, like in Wilmer, was that a low-interest loan, or was that a grant?
Commissioner Tangerpol.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is our practice that these dollars are invested into projects in the form of a deferred loan. So what it is, it goes in at 0% interest for the long term, and generally as long as that housing continues to be used to house low and moderate income households, it does not have to be repaid. But if, for example, someone were to want to convert one of these properties to market rate, then we would require them to repay the dollars. So it is not a grant. It is a deferred loan that can be recaptured if the use is changed in the future.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, on these projects, then, can I assume that when they apply, they give you a pre-design, they give you a project plan, all these different things, and then that's approved, and then they move forward with that. So in the case of the Lakeview High-Rise 2014 selection, so that would have been completed by this time, correct?
Commissioner?
Well, at least it hasn't been completed, I guess.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, the vast majority of the projects are completed. Some of them have taken a little longer just because of engineering issues or closing issues, but the vast majority of the GO bond projects are completed, and the vast majority of the housing infrastructure bonds, which since those are new construction, took a little longer, are either completed or under construction.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your being here. I had specifically asked because I wanted to be sure that everyone was aware of this unusual opportunity, and this was because of better interest rates, I think, and others, that you still have debt service available for an additional $20 million, but you don't have the authorization to do the additional. So with no more debt service, there's $20 million that could go out in projects.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. So the way that housing infrastructure bonds work is that the legislature provides both a maximum authorization amount, but also has to provide estimated debt service to service that maximum. But because interest rates have been extremely affordable over the time period when we've actually issued these bonds, we've been able to issue them at rates that were lower than the estimated debt service amount. So we all have to make estimates at the beginning, and we think we're fortunate that we were able to bring the money to the table at a less expensive rate than was estimated, and there is that opportunity that if you saw fit to increase the authorization, we could issue about $20 million more in bonds without needing additional debt service.
Thank you. Just from my standpoint, you know, I think you do a good job, you know, efficiently spending the money. The $100 million, for example, in 2014. Just have a question. In 2015, I believe you received $10 million in housing infrastructure bonds. About $2.7 million of that remains unissued. Is there any reason why there's some unissued money? Representative Carlson?
No, I just wanted to be on your list.
I thought you were going to ask the question for me.
No.
Okay.
Just wanted to be added.
We got you. That came from an MMB document. I'm just wondering. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, there may be a small portion of authorization that has not been used simply because there wasn't enough to do one more additional whole project. So there may be a small portion that wasn't needed for the projects that were selected, but there wasn't enough left in order to do a whole complete project.
Okay, that seems reasonable. Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I kind of perked up when you showed the upper post at Fort Snelling. I grew up a good bicycle ride away from the fort in South Minneapolis, and I've always been kind of interested in it. So I've got two questions. You may have answered this or pointed out in your testimony, but is that rental, or the one that you show here, is that rental or is that ownership?
Commissioner Dingerfall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a rental project. It consists of actually three buildings. There are two duplexes that house veteran families, and then the photo you see there is a renovation of a historic set of stables, of all things, that have been completely revamped into efficiency apartments for veterans that have experienced homelessness. And it is quite a remarkable community of people who have experienced homelessness now coaching some of their peers as they come in and really having the opportunity to take part in the resources that are available at the VA, which is just across Highway 62 from where this is.
And Mr. Chair, a follow-up to that, being that you referenced being close to the Veterans Hospital, is there a fair turnover there? Are they there kind of typically temporary while they perhaps are accessing the Veterans Hospital, or is it, even if it's rental, somewhat permanent residency?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is permanent housing, so there's no requirement that somebody move out after 2 years or after they stop using the services. They may choose to live somewhere else because they, they may want to live a bit more independently in the future, but there's no requirement that they move. And to the extent that they would get a job and have higher incomes, less of their rent would be subsidized, so there may be some incentives for folks to move. I should have mentioned that there's also another project that is immediately across Minnehaha Avenue from the VA that is currently under construction and will open later this year, which will provide another 100 units of similar permanent supportive housing for veterans. And that will help to hopefully cut the remaining number of homeless vets to less than half of what it is right now. So we're really closing in on that goal.
And Mr. Chairman, I think it sounded to me initially and even more so now that that's a good match with the close proximity to the Veterans Hospital. And I think, we've been out at times visiting Fort Snelling, and there have been conversations in the past and some movement in terms of what we can do to preserve the historic value of a lot of those buildings. And so maybe this is a good approach to help preserve some of them. I didn't realize looking at the picture, Mr. Chairman, that this was a former stable, but kind of an interesting development. Thank you.
Representative Sock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to see if you can comment a bit about East Gage and Rochester. It's obviously a project that I watched get built, and I've got people that, I'm aware of in terms of the structuring of this? Could you talk a bit about how, and maybe you don't know the project so specific as this, but how many and how much leveraged funds and contributing agencies kind of circled around this project particularly? And then I'll just offer an editorial, is that this thing has brought a significant impact to our homeless challenge that we had in town, and particularly in the two client groups that are addressed here, it has significantly dropped the number of homeless teen youth, if you will, those who might otherwise be attempting to be independent but not necessarily have a place called their home, and then also the people with young families. That those two groups were, this is really an important step. But anyway, if you could talk a bit about leveraging the funds and how your agency has assisted in creating that consortium.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would like to defer to one of your other testifiers. Nancy Cashman from Center City Housing is prepared to testify about Gage East, and her company is the management company, so she knows far more than I do about the details.
Well, bring her on up.
First of all, be brief, but secondly, identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Nancy Cashman. I'm with Center City Housing, and I appreciate the question. These housing infrastructure bonds really helped us to leverage a lot of other resources from the community. It's primarily around operations and services, but we did also receive $500,000 from the Federal Home Loan Bank of Des Moines, which helped with the capital costs. Our biggest partner in this project has been Olmsted County, which has provided 30 Section 8 certificates, so all of the families on the family side have a Section 8 voucher, which really helps with affordability. On the youth side, the Olmsted County did give us 15 GRH group residential housing rate 2 beds. And then because we're housing 16 to 21-year-olds, and some of those youth are really in the responsibility of the county, the county is actually providing rent for 10 of the units, 5 out of funds from probation and 5 out of funds from community services, because it is much cheaper to house these youth in this apartment building than it is to have them in foster care and in the juvenile justice system. Our service funds, Olmsted County is also providing 2 case managers, social workers that are providing supportive services in the building, providing $20,000 a year to our TOTS program, which is providing on-site services to children birth through 5 years old.
Thank you. We got a question. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We almost missed you.
And Commissioner, yeah. Just get back to the Fort Snelling. There's other buildings there too that are in the old, that are in the upper Fort Snelling there. And I know I actually, back in the day, I took some classes, military classes in these buildings. Are there other buildings there that are being renovated also?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative, there's a very large cluster of buildings at Fort Snelling that is not currently being addressed. It happens that this stable and the 2 duplexes that were part of this project are somewhat remote from that big cluster of buildings that used to be the kind of the officer's row.
Right.
So it's, they're both at the upper post, but they're not immediately adjacent to each other.
And Mr. Chair, is there
Representative Detmer?
In the future, are we looking at developing these facilities? They're beautiful brick structures, very historic. They're going to be renovated in the future?
Commissioner Daniel Paul.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know that the Department of Natural Resources, which is responsible for the oversight of these buildings, has an interest in renovating them. I also know that it's quite a costly project, so that would undoubtedly need to be a discussion with this body about whether that would be a priority.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the buildings that the commissioner is talking about have finally now been secured so that they're boarded up, if you will, and mothballed. And I think it was part of the Hennepin County work for release type program or something like that that we talked about a few years ago. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I thought that the first step, because it is costly, was to try to get the buildings watertight and that kind of thing so that they wouldn't continue to deteriorate. That's maybe out of your purview, because that would probably be the Historical Society or DNR. But
comments on
just
that?
Just a comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can only comment because I live fairly close to the post, and I know that they have, in fact, replaced some of the roofs on the project so that they are now secure.
Okay. All right. Continue. Anything else?
There is one other person here who wished to make some comments about the general obligation bonds, if that's acceptable.
Well, just a few more minutes, and so call her up. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Barbara Dacey. I am the Executive Director for the Washington County Community Development Agency, and I also am the President of the Minnesota Chapter of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials. I want to testify today to thank you for past allocations of general obligation bonds for public housing rehabilitation. During the capital investment committee tours, you have seen important work that has been accomplished with the public housing infrastructure funding. The housing and redevelopment authorities take care of the day-to-day maintenance of their housing units and rely on state funds to take on the large capital needs, such as replacing roofs, replacing elevators, or updating HVAC systems. At Washington County, we received a state grant out of the 2014 allocation to complete needed heating and plumbing improvements to Whispering Pines, a 40-unit, four-story building in Forest Lake that was built 46 years ago in 1971. A majority of the folks that live there are over the age of 62 and are individuals with disabilities. The funding enabled the replacement of the boilers, water heaters with a new energy efficient models, and replaced failing fiberglass showers, mixing valves, and drain piping. It was also discovered during construction that there were several unrated plumbing cases, which means the enclosures for the piping going through the buildings had to meet current fire codes and also had to be properly separated at each floor. In addition, improvements were made to the heating system so that much less outside air is required to heat the atrium, and therefore less energy and less cost is needed to heat the building. All of these improvements ensure that current energy, building, and fire codes are met. They extend the life of the building, keeping operating costs at a minimum, and more importantly, our tenants are safe and secure. In closing, I would like to thank you for your past support of the program and respectfully request your continued support for this funding to allow us to maintain affordable housing in communities throughout the state of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Well, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
Next up is an overview by the City of St. Paul on the Palace Theater project. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Jonathan Sage Martinson. I'm the Director of Planning and Economic Development for the City of St. Paul.
Thank you.
So thanks for having us today. I'm happy to give you an update on the Palace Theater, a project that was funded in part by the state of Minnesota in 2014, and we're just about wrapping up construction. The Palace Theater, as you may know, is an economic development project that really was designed to have benefits for the state, region, and city was designed to preserve a historic asset and to expand the region's cultural options for arts and entertainment. The City of St. Paul partnered with the State of Minnesota, but also with First Avenue and Jam Productions to accomplish this project. The state provided crucial bonding support for the project. The original request, you may recall, is for $6 million in state bonding. In the end, the state provided $5 million in the 2014 bonding bill. The total project cost is about $15.5 million, so that's $5 million in state bonds and $10,560,000 from the City of St. Paul and the City's HRA, so about a 2-to-1 match by the City of St. Paul. As I mentioned, the grant was awarded in May 2014. We executed our grant agreement with the state in March 2016. Most of the intervening time was spent on design, due diligence, negotiating the final details of the operating agreement with the operator, and then securing the city funding for the match. Construction work began in September 2015. First thing we did was to stabilize the roof and structure prior to the winter. Once we got in and did that stabilization, our team realized that it probably wouldn't have lasted another winter with the amount of water that was coming down through the roof. So we were able in September 2015 to get in and do that first stabilization of the project. Construction lasted about 16 months, utilized over 55,000 labor hours, with really great participation of workforce for minorities and female on the job. Our project team included Ortel Architects, McGough Construction as our construction manager, and NTH as the owner's rep for the city. The first public event was a series of open house celebrations were held on December 16th, 2016. About 500 people attended those events to get a sneak peek at the theater. The theater is what I'd say is 99.9% done. We are hanging the final curtains this week and next with the opening weekend planned for March 10th. The theater has a capacity of just over 2,800 people. 2,830 is the official capacity for the theater. As I mentioned, the first show that First Avenue and Jam Productions will put on is going to be on March 10th. There's a three-day opening weekend. Currently, they have 14 shows. They've just started booking, obviously, with the first shows coming up next month. But there's 14 shows that have been booked. The farthest out is in October. We know a great response so far and that many of the early shows have been sold out.
Could you give me an example of who is going to be performing?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the first two shows on opening weekend are Atmosphere and the Jayhawks, two Minnesota acts that will be the first two shows. Regina Spektor is probably one of the best well-known artists that's coming up just a little later in March. That show, I believe, is one that is sold out.
I'm available for book readings, but probably a bit beyond that.
Mr. Chairman, I will make a note of that and send it over to Jam Productions and First Avenue.
Okay.
The City and First Avenue Jam Productions are projecting between 50 and 100 shows and other events per year with a total annual of attendance of about 200,000 people. Obviously, bringing as a attractor of 200,000 people throughout the year, that's a big, important economic project for the state, for the metro, and for the city. And really, as a modern music venue, the theater builds upon the contemporary music scene and arts and culture, both in the metro and in downtown St. Paul, but in the state as a whole. Arts and entertainment are a real big livability driver. We know they drive economic development. They drive the location of employers and employees who want to be near that livability access to arts. And that is a big economic driver, not only for the City of St. Paul, but really for the region and for the state.
Well, what did you base your estimates on how many people will be attending?
Mr. Chairman, the number of shows that the operator will do was done in consultation with the operator. They have a minimum amount they need to perform annually, and the estimations is they will go up from that minimum up to about 100 a year, and that's on average attendance of 2,000 per show. So that is some shows sold out, some just a little under 2,000. For an average of 2,000.
Okay.
One important note is that the Palace Theater fills an important niche, really, in the theater scene for the state, in that at 2,800-person capacity, it has kind of a unique standing room general admission on the first floor with a seated balcony up above. It provides home for shows and performances that might otherwise not stop in the state. So to give you some perspective, this is about half the size of Roy Wilkins Auditorium in St. Paul, or about half the size of the Myth in Maplewood. It is also twice the size of First Avenue in downtown Minneapolis. So this is a niche that hasn't existed for modern music. Often some of those acts have decided not to book shows as opposed to doing two shows when they come to Minnesota. So it fills a real capacity, not only for the region, but really, I think, for the state in terms of the size and the configuration. The estimations taken from other art studies that have been done is that each show that skips about a 2,500-person show that skips the state is about $200,000 in lost economic activity. That is just over half of that is estimated on the ticket price itself, and then the remainder shows from studies of what patrons spend on other expenses, whether that be going out to dinner, parking, having beverages afterwards. So those studies show missed show in this range, about 2,500 for the state is about 200,000 in lost revenue. With 50 to 100 shows per year, that's somewhere between $10 and $20 million of economic activity for the state. Locally, the theater also has begun to spur, and we believe will spur more activity right in St. Paul. So it's already enlivened 7th Place Mall. We've seen bars and restaurants who are anticipating that kind of activity. We're seeing new bars and restaurants that are locating nearby. The development of Wabasha Center, which is at the end of the block of the 7th Place Mall, is being redeveloped by Hempel Companies. And they've cited that the location of the Palace Theater half a block away has helped them attract office tenants and retail and entertainment tenants to that redevelopment just down the block. It's important to know that the Palace Theater also preserves an important historic asset. This theater, it was built in 1916. It's a 100-year-old vaudeville theater. The preview for the first opening was the Marx Brothers. That was done in December 2015. And so this theater has a long history. It has sat vacant, however, since the 1980s, basically, and really just deteriorated since then. So the opening of the Palace Theater as a modern music venue has preserved that historic asset in a relatively inexpensive way. Had the theater been torn down and rebuilt, for example, it would have been a much more expensive project. The city's Housing and Redevelopment Authority, of which I also serve as the executive director, it is the owner of the building, so we own the building itself. It is managed and operated, as I mentioned before, by a partnership between First Avenue and Jam Productions. They book all of the shows, including providing access for community members. So part of the agreement is that St. Paul high schools have the ability to put on a show each year. So it's available for community shows as well. The maintenance and operations costs are all covered by the operators. So the ongoing maintenance cost is the responsibility of First Avenue Jam Productions. The city, as the owner, monitors the operator's performance and makes sure we meet all the state requirements, etc. And with that, I'm happy to answer any specific questions folks have about the theater. As I mentioned, we're putting up the final curtains, and the opening will be in just a few weeks here.
Okay, thank you. And I want to just announce that I had asked somebody to call me during this time as an example for you guys. You're not supposed to have your cell phones on during this meeting. So I hope you take, you know, a message here that...
it's pretty smooth, isn't it? Huh?
Hello?
Representative Eklund?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just to let the chairman know, as president of my steelworker local, $5 went to the beverage fund for every phone that went out there.
Dan Lilly, quit this. Actually, Representative Allison?
Mr. Chairman, when I was chairing a meeting, I announced that I would appreciate it if everybody would turn their cell phones off, and I think everybody did except the chairman. And a short time later, just like I was out of the room when yours rang, but sure enough, my phone rang.
Well, just in full disclosure, explain why I took the call. My that was Rice Hospital in Wilmer telling me to get there quicker on Thursday morning before I on Friday morning. So they are, my knee, you're all aware, they're going to put me to sleep, and you know, that sounds like a dog.
No.
So what, that bill already passed you at this stage?
They're going to knock me out and physically, manually move my knee around.
Oh.
So that's what that was about.
I could take care of that.
Yeah, you got it. All right. So where were we?
No.
Okay, we have some questions. Representative Hausman.
Oh, well, mine was just really following up on your little lighthearted thing, but I'm glad to tell it now because Representative Carlson's back in the room. When we toured the palace and we realized there would be no seats on the main floor, Representative Carlson wondered where he would put his drink, at which point the mayor said, Representative Carlson, if you're here, we've done something wrong. That's the niche market is aiming at.
Representative Uglow.
You have a good memory. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman, does that mean you're not a big Jayhawks fan or whatever? Mr. Martinson, I have a couple questions about, okay, you mentioned that the Redevelopment Authority or whatever is the owner. And from a lease arrangement and everything else, are you able to retire debt in the lease arrangement and reduce essentially the cost up front to the city of St. Paul, the $15.6 or $5 million in terms of cash flow and debt reduction with the lease with Jimmy Jam and those guys?
Yes, so
Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the city contribution to the project comes in two forms. It comes in a grant form from the HRA, and there is also a loan from the city of St. Paul. The city loan portion is eligible to be paid back through a ticket surcharge that is charged on each of the tickets sold, and there's also a small profit sharing at the end of the year on profits made by the operators at a schedule that's laid out in our lease or in our operating agreement. And so we do expect a small stream of funding to kick in year three. The arrangement with the operators is they'll have 2 years to essentially build the market and book the shows, and that ticket surcharge will kick in year three.
Follow up? Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Mr. Martinson, so how long is it going to take before you end up being able to pay back your investment?
And Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the lease term we have, the operating agreement we have with First Avenue and Jam Productions is a 15-year operating agreement. It would take longer than that 15 years to be fully paid back and a fairly robust attendance at the events. We have run estimations, you know, depending on how many shows they book, how many tickets they sell, that it would be somewhere between 20 and 30 years for the city loan to be paid off.
And like a legacy bill.
Okay. One other question.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the Palace Theater, I mean, it's an old building and everything else, but could you talk a little bit about the cost overruns and the delays that the project incurred?
Mr. Dave Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, is happy to. So there haven't been delays in timing in terms of the construction of the project. That 16-month construction timeline is the original timeline we've set out essentially from the beginning. The cost did go up during the course of the project. So we added just about $900,000 to the budget I'm going to say about 6 months ago, the HRA provided that additional funding to the budget. Once we got into the building, we found out that the infrastructure was in greater distress than we had originally anticipated, so there was more structural work to be done. One of the things we found once we got into the building and began working on it, for example, is that the heating and cooling equipment originally designed to go on the roof, that the roof wasn't structurally sound enough to hold the heating and cooling equipment, so that heating and cooling equipment was brought inside to a different location, which works just fine, but was an additional cost than we had anticipated. We also found some structural damage that we had to shore up in addition because of all the water damage that was in there. So like a lot of projects, a 100-year-old building, we found some things once we got inside and began doing that work and had to adjust the budget accordingly.
Yeah, one last question. So, you know, obviously an old building, and we found out when we were renovating the Capitol that there's lots of surprises and things, but what did you use for an architectural contingency in terms of percent? I mean, obviously, standard is 10. You know you're going into a huge old building that's going to have these problems. Did you anticipate that for your contingency money?
Mr. Dave Martinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we did. I don't have an exact percentage here, but my memory is it was just about 10% in our original budget. It was about 9% or so. The total contingency when we added the additional funds, again, I don't have the percentage right in front of me, but I believe it was about 17-20%, which is not out of line from our experience working with developers doing historic renovation work.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sage Martinson, as I'm sitting here, I actually think I may need to talk with you offline sometime because the chair's not going to be happy with all the questions that I have. But if you could kind of steer me in the direction of a couple things. My responsibility is not what St. Paul does with their money, but my responsibility is for bonding money when I hear $5 million going towards a project. When I just jotted some of the things in greater Minnesota, like sewer water projects and flood mitigation. So that's a lot of money, okay, for a project. So that's where my jealousy stands. So I hope you understand that. So just a couple questions, and then I can probably let it go for now. So one quick question. The amenities in this, I haven't been in the place off the tour some time. But is there anything, is it just a concert hall with some seats and some on the floor? I mean, is there a bar in there? Is there, what exactly, if you could give me just like the 30-second outlook of what this place is like for a concert goer?
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. So the theater itself has a balcony with seats, original seats that were refinished. The main floor, the seats were taken out, and it's a series of tiers, so it's a three-tiered floor that's standing room only. Seats can be installed temporarily on that main floor. There's also a raised stage that all of that looks onto. The main entryway, as you come in, has both a stairway up, and then it does have a bar that is between the lobby, and that standing room only space as well. Mm-hmm. And then there are a series of bathrooms both in the basement and a handicap accessible right in that lobby area. And then there is underneath the stage, essentially, there's some private space for the performers to get ready for the show.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sage Martinson, who gets the revenue from that bar? Is it St. Paul or is it Jam and First Avenue?
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. It follows the same revenue in total for the project, which is that the revenue goes to operate the building to First Avenue and Jam Productions, and then we do a profit sharing at the end of the year where the city gets 5% of profits over a certain threshold to help repay that financing that's put into the project. So the vast majority goes for the operations of the theater.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
I'll keep this to a final question. So, thank you.
There'll be a final answer.
Yeah. So this kind of sounds like the deal that the Vikings got, because what I'm seeing here, and I'm doing very rough math. You said 2,000 per show, 50 shows a year, so that was 100,000 people. Now, back when I went and saw my Journey concerts in Kansas and stuff like that, $30 a ticket, I'm guessing the venues are probably anywhere from $25 to maybe $100. I don't know. But I'm doing just $30. That's $3 million plus liquor. It seems like there's some pretty serious revenue being generated here. So for it not to be, the debt not to be paid off, much less the revenue that they're carrying. I mean, I guess my question is, did Jammin' First put any money into this project, or is this all in the state and on the city of St. Paul? Because they got a pretty good deal going here.
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. So Jam Productions and First Avenue are required to provide all of the sound and light system that goes into, as well as the final finishes on their point of sale and bar equipment. So they're doing a combination of capital outlay and leasing of equipment to run the theater. But they had to provide essentially the things that make the theater work. We're providing the space. They're providing point of sale, sound and light system, et cetera.
One final question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your patience with me. Mr. Sage Martinson, so the other local businesses there, there are restaurants and other things in that area. Are they viewing this as the fact that this place has a bar and has kind of its own economic little microsystem there? Are they viewing this as an asset? Do they believe that they're going to get some of the collateral business off of this?
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, very much so. They're very excited about the opening of the Palace Theater, the attraction of upwards of 200,000 new patrons to downtown St. Paul. Immediately adjacent to the Palace, there are two bar restaurants that serve food. That will not be the case in the Palace Theater. There will be no food served there. There are new restaurants moving into the Wabasha Center, which is half a block away just to the east. I'm very excited about this additional patrons. If folks have been downtown St. Paul prior to a Wild game, for example, that's the level of excitement I think that folks have in terms of you see restaurants and places filling up before the event takes place. And the bars and restaurants in St. Paul are expressing that kind of interest and excitement about this as an additional attractor.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Representative Rubin and Miller have asked the questions I was going to ask you. So through the testimony that they were answered. I guess actually one clarification, so it sounds like the City of St. Paul intends to hold this property, not sell it now that it's completed. Would that be accurate?
Sage Juergensen.
What?
Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's right. So in accordance with the state rules for the bonding, the city and the HRA in this case are the owner, will remain the long-term owner.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Miller asked the question that I was going to ask, but can you just tell us about the ticket prices? You kind of guessed at what the ticket prices would be. Can you tell us matter-of-factly what they are?
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, so I have not yet purchased a ticket for one of these opening shows, but I believe that is a good estimate. I haven't seen what all of the shows, there was one announced yesterday, I don't know what those ticket prices are, but I think in that $30 to $50 range are probably a pretty good estimate.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. People used to come into a city to shop, and now they come into a city to be entertained. And so a city that keeps its vibrancy and economic competitiveness turns to arts and culture very often as that new direction. We periodically bring out these tables, and maybe it's time to do that, but in this metropolitan area, and particularly the urban core between Ramsey and Hennepin, the majority of taxes are generated here. This is the economic engine, and then it goes all over the state for water projects and whatever, and we like to do that. That's because we think we all do better when we all do better, when all parts of the state are healthy. But I think that's the partnership that we're in, and it certainly is fair when we look at that final bill to have all of the parts of the state, including those areas where we are heavily paying for it, to also have part of that partnership with the state.
Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sage Martinson, I guess I'm not clear on this. Now, back to the tickets a little bit. The ticket surcharge, my first question would be, I have a couple, Chair, would be, you said in 3 years you'll start to institute a ticket surcharge, and that is, if I'm correct, to repay the debt service?
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay. So then that answered that question. I guess my second question would be, you know, here again, I think kind of playing a little bit of what my colleagues on this side have said is, you know, we have another situation where there's a lot of tax dollars going into this, and I think that's the big concern, whether it be the amount of the city of St. Paul or the $5 million from the state, and then on top of it, the citizens have to repay the debt, not only give the debt and issue the debt through us, but or through the city of St. Paul. On top of it, they get to repay the debt through the ticket surcharge. Now, I guess I could follow up with a question, Mr. Chair. The revenue sharing at the end, where does that money go to? Is that towards debt repayment, or is that towards operation, or into St. Paul City coffers?
Mr. Sage Martinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if I could try and answer both of those things. So the relationship with the operators doesn't dictate the ticket surcharge total that they charge. So they're free to charge a ticket surcharge, as you see in a lot of events. What is dictated is how much of that surcharge comes to the city, and there's a graduated amount. So the more tickets they sell, the higher the ticket surcharge is. So it's very likely that the operators would charge a ticket surcharge regardless. What we're mandating here is what amount comes to the city from that surcharge. Comes as part of the surcharge. They could continue to charge it anyway. They could charge more than that surcharge. Your second question was on revenue sharing. It goes to the same place. So the revenue sharing is at the end of the year when we total up any of the profits over $300,000, 5% of that also comes to help pay the city debt.
Representative Willie, I'll say this. Representative Willie, Representative Dean, the last two questions are the other ones, so try to keep them kind of short.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, mine's more of a comment. I'm pretty excited about this venue. I'm one of these families that we probably go to at least one music event a week, if not more, throughout the year, and probably for the last 10 years. So I'm excited. This partnership with First Avenue First Avenue is known not only obviously here in Minnesota, but worldwide. Jimmy Jam, you know, instant credibility worldwide. So, you know, it's pretty exciting partnership. I mean, I have high hopes for you, and I hope it turns out that gap that you talk about is of interest. There's these bigger venues like the Excels and the Target Centers, and then there's the smaller ones. I happen to have the Myth fairly close to us, but this niche is definitely a needed spot, and it'll be popular, I think. There's some public money in it, but if you saw the building, you know, we've put money in this sort of building all over the state. We've toured and seen a lot of them, I think they're good public investment. So that's mostly my comment. I'm sorry I got longer than brief. But my final comment is, I understand you're the economic developer or director for the city. I just want to express my disappointment that there's no free parking by Candyland anymore. And I think that's of deep concern to many St. Paul visitors. So I strongly suggest you deal with that issue. That's probably more of a problem than the ticket prices.
Is that where you get that good popcorn?
No, I'm not saying.
And then let me say, Representative Willie, that just a couple nights ago, Representative Paul Anderson was complaining about that same thing. I mean, he's a frequent Candyland visitor.
There are some legitimate concerns there, and I expect that you'll deal with that, sir.
Representative Willie, I'm just wondering, when you go to these venues, do you dance?
No comment.
Representative Dean,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of hard to follow. They do still have a couple of parking meters in front of Cameron, and if you're lucky to get one, you can give them out for like 75 cents, so it's not too bad. So I'm getting a little concerned because, you know, the projects in the city are somewhat unique. They're not quite as cut and dry and simple as waterworks projects or flood mitigation projects. You know, oftentimes they involve a different type of public and partner relationships. And you know, I'm just going to say that I would never talk to folks in Otter Tail County about my concern of the money that's going to Otter Tail County. Because it's important that Otter Tail County gets the resources it needs for those projects that are critical to that. So I guess instead of asking a question, I'll just leave out that and move on to the next project. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Sage-Meinson, for the report, and hopefully your answers have enlightened some of the members' questions. Thank you. Now we have the City of Minneapolis and the Nicollet Memorial Project. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourselves for the record, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Don Elwood. I'm the Director of Transportation Engineering and Design for the City of Minneapolis Public Works Department. My group does all roads, delivers all roadway bridges and bike trails for Minneapolis.
And Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Kramer. I'm the President and CEO of the Minneapolis Downtown Council and Downtown Improvement District.
Thank you. Again, please.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Today, my topic is an update for the Nicollet Mall project. Today I'm going to cover an overview of Nicollet Mall, cover project process and milestones along the way, and then cover present status and some next steps that we have on the project. Nicollet Mall is a unique project, and it's known across the region and across the state. People know about it, people talk about it, and people want to come and see it. Nicollet Mall is a destination, and people I talk to, they all have their own Nicollet Mall story. Nicollet Mall is also unique as a public-private partnership. The Minneapolis Downtown Council, as part of their 2025 plan, made the redesign of Nicollet Mall a priority. I'm happy to be joined today with Steve Kramer because we are partners on this project. The Minneapolis Downtown Council reached out to the City of Minneapolis and that partnership was formed. An implementation committee was established consisting of public and private members. The Nicollet Mall Implementation Committee developed the guiding principles that I have up on the slide today. It's a place for people. It's pedestrian friendly. It's green. It has year-round use. We want to activate all 12 blocks of the mall, and it's an integrated transit mode. Elegant and durable design. Urban design, durable materials, and cost-effective operation and maintenance. The Nicollet Mall Implementation Committee developed the concept plan and then sought funding to move it forward. The scope of the project is a total redesign and reconstruction from building phase to building phase. Grant to Washington. What we're taking out is all the slippery granite sidewalk, removing the old roadway, the lights, the signals, bus shelters, and everything else, all the clutter that's in the sidewalk today. And along with the mall, most of the utilities are being upgraded. What we're putting back is a new pedestrian clear walk zone, more green with trees and plantings, a new elegant lighting system, and raised intersections for the pedestrians where the roadway comes up to match the level of the sidewalk. This helps make this project a destination for people to come to visit. The project features are also going to be added. There's some signature features, which I'll show pictures of later. Theater in the Round, the reading room, the Art Walk and the Light Walk are signature features for the mall. Budget. The budget is a partnership, public-private funding. There's $21.5 million of bonds, $3.5 million city funds, and the private funding at $25 million in special assessments. The uses of the funds, rough breakout of construction is $35 million, fees and other costs at $15 million to match the $50 million. Presently, the project is on budget and tracking to stay on budget. I'd like to talk now about process and what I've experienced along the way of the Nickel Mall project. In 2012 and 2013, the implementation committee was formed, and through a design competition, James Corner Field Operations was selected as the design firm. The partnership conducted meetings to develop the concept design. In June of 2014, the concept design was approved and the public funding was secured, 21.5 from the state, 3.5 from the city, and then the schematic design started. Prior to moving into final design, it was discovered that the center island median concept was not feasible. The project stakeholders did not support it. In the spring of 2015, the private funding was secured through approval of the special assessments for $25 million, and now I had a fully funded project. The construction plans were bid out, and in December of 2015, when we opened the bid, I had a single bid that far exceeded my ability to accept the bid, and it was rejected. This resulted in a redesign and a repackaging of the project while still keeping the guiding principles intact. We revised the bid package, bid that out, and got the results that allowed us to move forward with the project. The contractor started work in June of 2016. Along with our project, there's also significant utility work in the corridor. Some of that utility work is directly related to the design that need to be relocated because of the project, but there's a large portion of that utility work which is upgrades for the future. The existing utility infrastructure is old and in need of repair, and fixing it now will meet the future demand and help prevent digging up the mall. That relocation started in 2015. We've achieved about 6 months of work on the project, six to eight months worth of work on the project prior to winter shutdown. We will start up again this spring in 2017 and get substantial completion by fall of 2017. There will be some landscape work that carries over into 2018. Some of the tree species cannot be planted except in the spring.
What caused the bid to be rejected? I mean, obviously cost.
Yeah, maybe I'll talk about that time. So this was December last year, and we put the bid out, and we put the project out for bids, and we got one single bidder responded back, and that the dollar amount of that bid far exceeded my available budget to move forward. So at that point, I had to reject it and repackage it. We did a redesign of the project at that point, but we still kept the project principles intact. So essentially I modified from concrete pavers to cast-in-place concrete with a stencil design. Same durable materials, same material.
So it also recost the project. Cost of pavers, was that much more over what you wound up with? Is that what you're implying was the large difference?
Mr. Chair, I think that because I got a single bid and a single dollar amount, it's hard for me to determine what the exact cause. I got a single data point out there, so it's hard to say, is there a cost savings? Can I cut the project to get that kind of cost savings? But I only had a single bid. If I would have had multiple bids around that same dollar figure, that would have been different. But we took a look at this project and we repackaged it and bid it again. Present progress and conditions. There's three main parts to this project. There's below ground, which is utility work. There's at ground, which is irrigation, electrical, and paving, the surface that goes in. And there's an above ground component, which are trees and lights and features. So I'm really in charge of a three-dimensional project that's going on called Nickel Hall. Most of the surface is in place from Grant to 11th, including the west side of 10th, and there's a portion up at the IDS that's also in place. This past winter, or during the wintertime, we've been working on sewer construction. Our partners of Xcel Energy have been doing work, and we've started to put in some of the features that I spoke of earlier. The stencil design, the concrete stenciling, is a process that, well, I guess in the upper left-hand corner, there are metal stencils. Once the concrete is placed and the concrete sets up, these stencils are put down, and there's a high-pressure etching process that goes on to leave that permanent mark in the concrete sidewalk. At the woods, which the woods are on both ends of the project, what I have in the left-hand side of that photo is, here's what we were showing during concept design. And on the right-hand side, here's what I have in place today. At the groves, portion of the project called the groves, left-hand side, here's what I've been showing at the concept design, right-hand side, here's what we have in place. And at Nicollet Center, again, here's what we've been showing and what we have today. The irrigation system for the trees is quite extensive. What I'm showing in this photo here is the white lines. That's the irrigation system. We have what's called tree baskets that preserves the spot for the trees, so I know exactly where they're going to go. And then once all that's in place, we pave over the top. There's some complex concrete forming that's going on in this project. We have different colors and different style of concrete that's going in. It all has to be placed in the proper sequence. Upper left-hand corner is how we're doing the forming. Lower left corner is what it looks like after they put that portion of concrete in, and then that preserves the space for the groves that goes in a different color. Raised intersections, the raised or tabled intersections. The concept is to have the roadway come up to the same level as the sidewalk. So as a pedestrian, the experience you have as a pedestrian on the mall is a clear walk zone from one end of the mall to the other. Excuse me. In that upper left corner, we're showing the crosswalks are a different color concrete to clearly indicate where the pedestrians should be. On the right-hand side, this is a completed intersection at 11th. That intersection is done and gives you an idea of what that's going to be like from the pedestrian experience. Here's a photo of the reading room, which is down near Loring Park. We have the foundation put in place, and on the right-hand side of that photo is the bench, the actual bench that's going to be used. It's pieced together so you can make a nice curve. And then we'll add the wood in on the top, the slats for the bench on top of that when we get those in, get those delivered. But the foundation's put in place, and we have that work completed. This picture here is of the groves from the Skyway. And this is right near the local and the newsroom down in that part of the mall. What you see on the photo on the right-hand side, that's not the road, that's the future grove area. And those holes that you see, that's the trees. They're ready to put the trees in. So we have the clear pedestrian walk zone, which is right up along the building face. And then this whole grove area is available for the pedestrian experience out on the mall. The roadway will be on the right-hand side of this, and there'll be a similar type of a pedestrian sidewalk on the far right-hand side. One of the features of the mall is the light walk. The engineers tell me this is called the armature, but it's the light walk. And on the left-hand side top corner, this is what we've been showing. It's a two block section in the middle with the louvered mirrors up on top to give you more light and give you more a different experience walking through. And there's also lights that change color. They're programmable, and they'll run in the sidewalk, up the side, and then over the top as well. This section is installed today. We put that in coming up on a month ago now. That's installed right now at 7th and Nicollet, and that's the approved prototype to move forward with putting it in for the rest of the project. Another piece is the furniture, movable furniture for the Nicollet Mall, and that we have some already delivered and ready to go. Others are at a warehouse, and those will be ready to put out as soon as they're feasible. I'd like to talk about complexities of delivery. The ACT-bound pedestrian access and control is significant. I'm providing a 10-foot walk zone through the project at all times. I need to maintain access across the corridor. And I need to maintain access into all the businesses. So essentially, I'm trying to keep things open, keep it moving, and at the same time, make it safe. And to do that, we have about 2 miles of pedestrian fencing put in to keep the pedestrians out of the construction zone. We have signs, detours, temporary sidewalk built out of wood as needed, and I built bridges to get people into the buildings because they're open for business. Right in the middle of the construction project, they're open, and I need to make sure they stay open. I have temporary crosswalks, temporary signals, and temporary lighting out there, and build bridges as needed for access. Below ground, we're not many people see what happens. It's equally as challenging. The Nicollet Mall corridor is full. It is full of utilities, and the coordination of the underground work is extensive. There's impacts along the mall as well as all the crossing streets. Upgrades are needed now to keep pace with demand, and I need to keep the existing facilities operational while I put in the new. It truly is a three-dimensional puzzle underground of how I get all those lines to cross and how to make it all work. Communications has been a big portion of this project. We have web pages, obviously, for the project, but we also have weekly construction meetings. These are open to the public, and they occur every Friday. We will get into the details of what we're doing that week, what we got done last week, and understand what the problems are. We talk about updates and accomplishments. We do send out email blast communications. There's obviously media on this project, and we also do one-on-one individual meetings. I personally meet with businesses as often as I can. I walk them all frequently during the week, and I will talk with the businesses and find out what their concerns and issues are. we do as much as we can to communicate so that these businesses can plan for what's going to happen next week. Looking ahead, in nominally April, we'll pick up where we left off. Work will progress a little differently because the land use changes as we head north on the mall, and every block will have intense construction occurring. In June, the trees start coming in, and I anticipate in July, the lights start coming in. That's that above-ground portion of the project. The businesses have been great to work with. They ask good questions. They've all been professionals, and they've been very helpful to us on the project. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Any questions, members? We have Representative Uglin first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elwood, I'm looking at some of your pictures here, and the, for instance, the Grove area, and then that mirrored area you referred to and everything else. We're expecting a snowstorm Thursday and Friday. I'm just wondering where you're going to plow the snow in these areas here because of the close proximity of the trees and the cement portions and mirrors and things to the road. How is the snow going to be removed?
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. Winter operations on all my construction projects are a concern. On Nickel Mall, that's a little different. We do have a plan for what I've been calling winter operations, working with the Downtown Improvement District, who is funded by the Business Association in downtown. They will be responsible ultimately for the maintenance of the mall. The operation and maintenance of the new mall will be responsibility of the Downtown Improvement District. What we do in the wintertime is I have a couple of priorities. Number one, I need to keep a lane open down Nicollet Mall for emergency vehicles. Public safety, that's number one. Number two, where do we put the snow? We leave that up to the contractor inside the fence. On the pedestrian side, it's a joint effort with the DID. So we need to move the snow out. Sometimes we can plow it to the side and leave it. Sometimes we have to do full removal. So with a large event like this on the horizon, I know the construction team is looking at that right now, making sure they have the stuff picked up. But that's essentially how it works.
Sure, if I could add, if your question, Representative, also referred to when the mall is complete, how will snow will right. be completed, as Mr. Elwood suggested, the Downtown Improvement District, our special services district in downtown, kind of works hand in glove both with the city, which has some responsibility for snow removal, and also private building owners, which has some as well. But ultimately, it's our job to make sure that the mall is clear and there are no slip hazards and it's a fully accessible mall. So our contractor is fully engaged in this project, know what faces them as these new design elements take shape. We'll have the appropriate equipment to fulfill that responsibility. And I would also say the new surface, as opposed to the granite pavers, the concrete surface, frankly, will be easier to and safer to keep slip-free. So we're looking forward to that.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Representative Wiggum.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. And, yeah, I'm sure it'll be kind of an expensive proposition to get rid of the snow. But, Mr. Kramer, I do have one other question now. With this major investment, and we all know that the Nicollet Mall is a centerpiece of downtown Minneapolis and all of that, but we know that the downtown area is really struggling for a number of reasons. With this major improvement, have you had any new businesses that have expressed interest in moving in just because of this improvement?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Mr. Kramer.
Thank you for that. A couple things. One, at our annual meeting about 10 days ago, not a new business, but Target CEO indicated they'll be investing $10 million to upgrade their store on 9th and Nicollet, so that was certainly a positive sign. I can also tell you, while we were not surprised but nonetheless disappointed by the closure of the downtown Minneapolis Macy's store, the new prospective buyer of that store, which I expect will be closing very soon, thank you, is making that investment because of their excitement about the pedestrian orientation of the new mall design. also some of the other prominent vacant spaces in downtown right now, the RSM Plaza building on 8th Street across from IDS for Barnes & Noble currently exists but will be closing. That owner, an investment firm out of Chicago, has exciting plans both for the first floor and the second floor. And again, their first floor plan relates very much to the new mall design. So I see a virtuous cycle occurring here of the mall being completed this year, largely completed, as Mr. Elwood indicated, and some quick investments, some of which have already been announced and others of which will be announced following very quickly and really helping to prove up the value of this kind of public-private investment, both with your generous investment at the state level, city fund, and the business community stepping up to provide $25 million through special assessments that were broadly supported. The $25 million special assessment for this project covered literally thousands of property taxpayers in downtown Minneapolis. I think at the end of the day, we had two or three appeals, mm-hmm. which is, I think, a remarkable testament to how the business community saw the value of this investment playing out over time.
Thank you.
Going back to a little earlier conversation, in retrospect, can you see anything in the pre-design process that you could have done differently because it led to the rebidding having to be done?
Mr. Chair, maybe it'd be good if I just talk a little bit about how we went from concept to construction. And you know, lessons learned on the bidding process, I guess. It you know, when I look at we had the concept design and then we move into the design phase. Okay? And as I go through the design phase, there's still significant stakeholders. And that stakeholder input comes into place, and we need to get more of the details about things on the project as we move forward. This is where our project can change. And it all starts, as we try to make it all start to fit together and still meet the vision, the design project needs to adapt to meet those needs. From the bidding process, I think from the bidding perspective, I need to make sure the contractors, they need to line up their work for the next year, but at the same time, they need to figure out what those prices are going to be in the future. So I can't go too early and I can't go too late. When we bid this project in the fall, I thought we had everything figured out. We had independent cost estimators. We had done all our due diligence, and we got that single bid. I thought we had taken all the right steps to get to where we needed to get to, and it did not happen.
Sure. Maybe I could just add very quickly to that. Don mentioned that there's a public-private implementation committee that helps oversee this project, and the private sector members include construction executives from Target, U.S. Bank, Hines. When the bid came in, and we were all very disappointed by the single bid, there was a quick kind of marshaling of resources, and the city was great about taking advice and input about how to proceed from there. I think one of the things that did probably in the end help, in addition to the redesign, was breaking the project into multiple bid packages. I think that perhaps opened the eyes of some potential bidders that weren't open before when it was one single package. So there are a number of things that occurred, again, reinforcing the public-private partnership that has really characterized this project right from the start.
Okay, thank you. We have 5 minutes, actually 4 minutes left, and two people for questions. So if we can try to move through them. Representative Carlson.
I was going to ask about the Macy's store, and that was already asked, so thank you.
Very good, Representative Carlson. Thank you.
I still call Dayton's building.
Yes, I agree.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you first started talking about this, the concept was a street as a destination center, and I think people imagined the pedestrian mall like the great European cities, and we see them. And so the businesses like the Dakota and all of those outdoor dining spots were shocked to discover that the bus had been moved off for the construction time, and then they discovered it was going to be moved back. And this just was a jarring bit of news, because a bus just doesn't seem to fit with this friendly, all these gathering spots and a street as destination and outdoor dining. And when I talked to somebody in the city, I was told that Metro Transit just said they couldn't make it work any other way with that. I mean, I would hope that the city would just push back on that a little bit and say, you can figure this out. I mean, to put this amount of effort into a destination spot and then put a bus on it, it was a surprise to businesses along there. I'm assuming they told you as well. At any rate, that's just a suggestion. The other one, I was actually a little surprised to still see that you have movable chairs here, because that was a feature that when we initially were told about that, there were some raised eyebrows. How in a city are movable chairs going to work when you normally think of fixed benches and so forth? But it's still here, so I assume it must still be in your plan.
It is. Mr. Chairman, I can very quickly address both points, Representative Hausman. First, I certainly accept your point that people may have been surprised. There's no reason for them to be surprised, because it was a parameter right from the start that the buses would come back. And we have had some experience now with relocating the buses in downtown, and it has caused, that were formerly on the mall, and has caused quite a bit of congestion where they were relocated. So I think not the unanimous view, but the consensus would be kind of restoring the bus pattern is probably the most sensible thing for downtown, and it has not deterred the very lively and wonderful sidewalk cafe culture on the mall, which I think will be enhanced by the design features. Many of the cafes will be in those tree groves that Don pointed out, and I think they'll be just marvelous, even though the buses will also be there. Movable furniture, we think it's going to work. We actually have experimented with it a little bit, not with the particular pieces that you see in the rendering, but we had no problems with some of the concerns that people have, and so we think it's going to be an interesting and engaging part of the design. People can move it up and kind of move the chairs around to where they're going to be talking to one another and the like, and I think it'll add a kind of a zest to the mall that wasn't there before. So we'll see. We'll certainly monitor that very carefully, but so far so good on that point.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Appreciate your giving us a report. It's helpful to us.
Some kids moving something.
And
busway.
For next week, just watch for
Stay tuned.
We'll see what happens. But as for now, as Sergeant Preston said to King, this case is closed.